I do not know when it began, but you do. It began with a discontent, with a gnawing at your soul. It began with an out-of-placeness. It began with heresy. Or perhaps it began with an expansiveness that drove you to seek. Perhaps it began with thoughtful inquiry. And it was a friend, an acquaintance, a colleague who was Jew, Christian, Hindu, an unchurched but discerning woman in your workplace who heard you speak and said, "Wait a minute, you sound like a Unitarian." And a member of this fellowship or another said, "Come visit my church." And it was not an intrusion, it was a kindness, it was a courtesy, because it helped you find your way home. No, no, you're a homebred Unitarian Universalist. Your parents or their parents looked for a church that they could safely entrust with what they held most dear, the hearts, the minds, the very souls of the next generation. And maybe you left the church in your teenage years but returned later in life with children of your own. Or maybe you remained through high school, the start of a job, through college graduation, your sense of belonging deepening through each and every one of those transitions. No, I know you. You searched on the web. You answered that survey on BeliefNet. You entered some magic combination of words, clicked the "I feel lucky" button, and you Googled your way to this saving faith. You see, I really do not know when it began, but each of you do. Remember your own beginning. Make a place for it in your heart, in your mind. Draw it near and let it be present to warm and inform you during our time together on this special morning. As you've probably heard by now, I am privileged to serve as moderator of the Unitarian Universalist Association, a wondrous, rich network of congregations nearly 1,100 strong, in which the Boise Unitarian Universalist Fellowship is an important member, an association that celebrates the joys and shares in the concerns of this congregation here in Idaho and sends me to vouchsafe that fact. I get many, many requests to preach, far more requests than there are Sundays in a year, and so I get to choose. I choose to be here this morning to express my gratitude for the critical difference that your minister, Elizabeth Green, is making right now in the lives of our association's members. I'm here and choose to be here because I hear through Elizabeth's stories, but also through the grapevine here in the Pacific Northwest, that you folks are growing in so many wonderful ways, and that I should check you out. I'm here to mark a milestone and to thank Elizabeth and this congregation for your amazing work together these two decades. Nancy Schaefer, our associate minister in Ann Arbor, Michigan, close to where I live, offers this poem called "Callings." When you heard that voice and knew finally it called for you and what it was saying, where were you? Were you in the shower, wet and soapy, or chopping cabbage late for dinner? Were you planting radish seeds or seeking one lost sock? Maybe wiping handprints off a window or coaxing words into a sentence, or coming upon a hyacinth, or one last no. Where were you when you heard that ancient voice, and did yes get born right then? And did you weep? Had it called you since before you even were? And when you knew that, did your joy escape all holding? Where were you when you heard that calling voice, and how in that moment did you mark it? How ever after are you changed? Tell us, please, all you can about that voice. Teach us how to listen, how to hear. Teach us all you can of saying yes. Both inside and outside of Unitarian Universalism, there are folks who think of calling as something that only pertains to our clergy. Ministers are called to congregations, fellowships search and then call religious professionals. Some fellowships call them, install them, and then stand back to say, "Is something going to happen here?" But after two decades, you know that's not how this thing works. For in our Unitarian and Universalist traditions, both clergy and the laity are called to minister, to participate in what UU theologian James Luther Adams called the priesthood and prophethood of all believers. There is a calling for each and every one of us, and when we hear it, it leaves a mark whether or not we answer. Where were you when you heard that ancient voice? And did yes get born right then? And did you weep? Had it called you since before you even were? And when you knew that, did your joy escape all holding? The concept of shared ministry, ministers and us lay folks working together, sits at the center of our tradition and at the lives of our congregations. For our congregations to transcend the ordinary, we need every person to hear their call and to find a way for yes to be born, to clear away every no that stands between our souls and the unique yes that we must give voice to, the yes that was given to each of us alone to live into being in the world. It is not enough for our ministers to find their ministries. We must all find our ministries. What is it that calls you, Nancy Schaefer asks, when you hear that ancient voice that knows your name? What does it summon you to do? These, then, I offer as mundane stories, everyday stories of lay people who have found a way to answer a call. Some names have been changed to protect the innocent, or not. Innocence is somewhat overrated. But Elizabeth knows John, and John and Sharon are lay leaders in their congregation in Kansas City. John was attending a required training about racism after General Assembly a few years ago. Elizabeth was there too. Sharon was hanging around waiting for her husband, as lay volunteers, partners, and spouses often do. And she said, "Could I come too?" We said, "Yes." After the training, Sharon returned to her congregation, and she kept thinking about this training, thinking about how her congregation could talk about accessibility, how her congregation could talk about gender issues, how they were a welcoming congregation. But they never talked about race. Not ever. She wondered, why not? And after much thought and some months, Sharon recruited another guy in the congregation, a volunteer, and together they provided a four-week class based on the book Soul Works. Since teaching the class, Sharon has helped leaders in other congregations who are also beginning to work on issues of race and class and ethnicity. When I asked Sharon, "Why are you doing this?" she told me her story, and then she said, "After I went to the training, I knew that someone needed to do this. And finally, I realized I could not wait for that someone to be anybody other than me." I said, "What was the hardest part?" And she said, "Having the courage to try." Sharon heard a call and answered, "Yes. What is it that calls you? When you hear that ancient voice that calls your name, that called you before you ever were, what does it summon you to do? And what are the no's that keep you from saying yes?" I was in New Orleans again last December, working in the town of Violette in St. Bernard Parish. St. Bernard was devastated by Hurricane Katrina, and people there continue to rebuild their neighborhoods and their lives. I traveled to Violette with a group of UUs from one of our congregations in Massachusetts, and the president of the Marblehead congregation is named Mary, and she got her brother, who's not a UU, not yet, but we're working on him, to drive over from Houston to work with us. John owns a company that is a composting and landscaping business, and he knows more about earthworms than any human being I've ever met. His company's name is Urban Worms. And I said, "Why did you come?" Because at this point we were still sleeping in unlit buildings on hard floors with sleeping bags and getting really tired every single day. And John said, "Oh, no, I had to be here." He said, "Ever since Katrina, I've known I was supposed to be doing something, but I never knew what to do. I never knew how to be involved. But I'm supposed to be here right now." And I said, "Wow." So John takes away from his business a whole week, takes a week off to drywall a home for a family he's never met. But I know he'll be back, and he'll bring friends along with him, because John heard his call and found his yes. What is it that calls you when you hear that ancient voice that knows your name? What does it summon you to do? congregations get called as well. The West Shore congregation in Cleveland just finished a multi-million dollar addition and renovation to their plant, and at the same time they raised funds for a microcredit bank for a small village in Guatemala. It was a big stretch. In the middle of this capital campaign, they realized there's something more that they're called to do. It was a big stretch, but the spirit there is strong and they're thriving. Despite the violence, our congregation in Dallas sends medical relief teams to Haiti. Every month, the congregation in Wellesley Hills sends a check to pay the mortgage of our first church in New Orleans. Each fall, the UU Society in Brooklyn, the closest congregation to the former site of the World Trade Center, hosts a Ramadan dinner for the Muslim community in the five boroughs, something they started immediately after 9/11. What is it that calls you? When you hear that ancient voice that knows your name, what does it summon you to do? I drove to Fort Lauderdale, Florida from New Orleans the first week of January in 2007, and somewhere up in the panhandle, I passed a billboard. I'm driving along at about 90 miles an hour because there's nobody else on the road at 2 a.m. And there's this billboard that says, "Welcome to Florida. Mortality 100%. Are you ready?" And at first I thought this was an ad for an insurance company, right? But then I realized that that little print at the bottom of the billboard was not a web URL, but it was a reference to the New Testament Gospel of John. So it actually made me long in that moment at 90 miles an hour for those kinder, gentler billboards that sometimes where I live, God takes out billboards herself. You know, there'll be a billboard signed God, right? Like some quit buying billboards using my name, God. Okay, all those kinds of things. And so then I'm wondering, what would our Unitarian Universalist God's billboard look like? Because I think if it was a UU God's billboard, it would have a different message. Because while we UUs don't share a common theology, we are probably agreed that this life is not a dress rehearsal for the next post-death life where life actually begins. In other words, we may not be certain about life after death, but we're pretty much clear that there's death after life. So, no, a UU billboard, the billboard that the UU God buys, would say something like, "Welcome to Florida, we're all going to die. Have you lived yet?" When you get to the end of your life, will you have lived? Will you have heard your summons, answered yes, and allowed your joy to escape all holding? Or will you only remember that you held fast to your complete inventory of reasons to say no? You can't take them with you either. What are the no's that keep you from saying yes, even today? Are there no's that you can let go of because they no longer serve? Are there no's that need work, that need your attention because they prevent you from saying yes to that which will make you most alive? What is the final no you must put away so that you can find your way to say yes? What is it that calls you when you hear that ancient voice that knows your name? What does it summon you to do individually and together as a community? You know, sometimes it's even harder for an entire congregation to find its yes, and this is easy to understand. Because even after I've gotten rid of all the no's that keep me from saying yes, I have to worry that you're dealing with your no's, which may be different than mine. But oh, my friends, when a congregation finds its yes, and you know this, when a congregation finds its yes, a truly miraculous and audacious future is possible. So I'm here to thank Elizabeth and this congregation for your amazing work, but also to remind you that the work is not yet completed. Our work is never completed, not in any year, not after any set of election results are announced, not in our lifetimes. Poet Denise Levertov reminded us we've only begun to love the earth. We've only begun to imagine the fullness of life. There is too much broken that must be mended. We only have begun to know the power that is in us, each of us, if we would join our solitudes in the community of struggle. See, we have only begun to know the power that is in us, only begun. Holy work it is that awaits us, and it's not enough for our ministers to find their spiritual centers. We must all find and name and cling tenaciously to that life force that grounds us. For a moment, let's turn the clock back 20 years. Many of you were here when this fellowship took a chance on a new minister, fresh out of seminary. Many of you were here when this smart minister took a chance on you. But even more of you have joined the fellowship more recently. What was it like to call a minister to this pulpit? What audacious risk did we have to engage in to be willing to know and be known to each other? The Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Atlanta, Georgia, recently called a new senior minister. And during the week when it's called candidating week. I know you don't know these things because you haven't had to do it in 20 years. There's this thing called candidating week. Minister comes, preaches a sermon, stays all week. You kind of run them through the gauntlet, and then at the end they preach again, and then the congregation votes. So during that week, my friend Dr. Tony Stringer spoke at one of the meetings about risk and love. And he says, I could go on with reasons why this was a difficult search, but I won't. I really just want to mention one reason this has been difficult that might not be on your list. It was a difficult search because we're difficult people. We really are, and you've got to love us for it. We're deeply complex and deeply flawed. It's part of what makes us interesting. We can accept gay and lesbian couples, cross-dressing men, uppity women, and all manner of eccentricity, but we struggle to accept that some of us believe in God and some of us don't. Some of us are so passionate about peace that we will rip the throat out of any minister who is just a little less passionate about this thing that we hold dear. We're complex. We're deeply flawed. We're interesting. We're some of the best people I know and some of the worst to get along with. Sometimes we're better at being honest than we are at being kind. But all the time, we mean well. We passionately believe in free speech so much that some of us won't stop talking. We want to be relevant to what is happening now as long as it doesn't require us to change anything. We want to grow our congregation as long as it doesn't get any bigger. We're a bundle of contradictions, lonely and needy despite being full and generous. We're a beacon of liberal religion and a bastion of humanist conservatism. We want a minister, but we're not sure what they're supposed to do. We want someone skilled and knowledgeable to lead us so that we can ignore him as we go our own way. We want someone to be out front so we can refuse to follow. We want someone to represent our point of view in the wider world, even though we can't agree on what our point of view is. Sometimes, Tony writes, I'm so frustrated with us, and sometimes, I am moved to tears by what we do together. We are deeply flawed. We are so interesting, and you have to love us for it. And then Tony spoke to the prospective minister and said, honestly, if you came looking for a perfect congregation, you won't find it here this week. He said to the congregation, and if we came looking for a perfect minister, we will not find one this week. This guy, he's too young, he talks too fast, and he has too much hair. And we've got to love him for it. We can love him, we can choose to love him. Just as he can love us, he can choose to love us. This has never been about finding the perfect minister. We don't love someone because they're perfect. If that were our criteria, we'd be loveless and alone, and we'd deserve to be. 20 years ago, the members of the Boise UU Fellowship took a leap of faith and dared to love Elizabeth Green. 20 years ago, Elizabeth took a leap of faith and dared to love you. You didn't know each other all that well then. It was probably easy to love. When you dare to love, you dare to love the parts that you knew, but you knew there would be more. Now, maybe there was somebody like Tony Stringer here to describe the complexity, to say there's more to us that you haven't seen yet. But you know, most of us expect the complexity. We understand that real love, is far more challenging than anything one learns in a week. Love requires the commitment to be authentically present all the time across those 20 years. Authentic religious love requires us to risk over and over and over again, to risk disappointment, to risk exposing our own flaws and fears, to risk audaciously so that we might be changed, transformed by loving and by being loved. If we love audaciously enough, we might create the space where we can learn to love ourselves. So what love, what yes, have you found here in Boise? I've only been here a day and a half, but this is a wonderful place. What a wonderful home for people who join you. And I know they are joining you. They're going to keep joining you. See, there's an often overlooked but critical piece of magic that happens when a congregation finds its loving yes. The possibilities for ministry, for individuals, are greatly expanded. And you can smell it in the air. So there are many, many people in Boise and the surrounding area who are looking for a place where they too can answer their call, where they can experience this love, where they can live their ministry, hear the summons, and finally throw away no and start saying yes. And they'll ask, is this a place where I can listen to my heart, where I can be held in community, where I can change just a small part of the world to make it more just? And you will open your arms and say yes and yes and yes. Listen for just a moment, and you'll hear all the yeses already present in this room. People will come to ask you how to listen, and you will teach them, and they will teach you. You'll hold each other in community and care, encourage each other to make a difference, just as you and Elizabeth have encouraged each other these two decades. This is precious work, this loving, shared ministry here in this community. I thank you for it. I close with the words of a Raya Mountain dreamer, offered as a prayer, as a meditation. Listen your way into this with me, with your whole self. I have heard it all my life, a voice calling a name I recognized as my own. Sometimes it comes as a soft-bellied whisper. Sometimes it holds an edge of urgency, but always it says, "Wake up, my love, you are walking asleep." There's no safety in that. Remember what you are and let this knowing take you home with every breath. Hold tenderly who you are and let a deeper knowing color the shape of your humanity. All you have ever longed for is here, in this place, in this moment, right now. There is one word you are here to say with your whole being. When it finds you, give your life to it. Don't be tight-lipped. Don't be stingy. Spend yourself completely on the saying. Be one word in this great love poem we are writing together. Amen.